The UK government is providing a range of economic, humanitarian, and defensive military assistance to Ukraine, often leading the way with a supply of new capabilities and categories of munition, which over the last 2 years has helped to encourage other allies to scale up their commitments. Britain seems to be less intimidated by Russia's so-called red lines and terroristic threats. Many of these red lines have proved to be illusory, just bluff and bluster of a bullying imperial power. We're going to examine some of these issues, including military, financial, and humanitarian issues, and the role the UK is playing in helping to lead support for not just Ukrainian survival, but also for victory. Welcome to the Silicon Curtain podcast. Please like and subscribe if you find our content interesting and our incredible speakers too. And also, please comment against the videos. It really helps them to perform in the algorithm within YouTube and helps people to discover the incredible materials they contain. Also, do check out the validated Ukrainian charities that appear in the description of this video. It's never been more important than it is now to help Ukraine remain resilient and to resist Russian aggression. Today, I'm going to be talking to Eduard Fesko, who is charge d'affaires at the Embassy of Ukraine in the United Kingdom of Great Britain and Northern Ireland. He has held a number of roles, both in the embassy in this country and in the sort of diplomatic service over a number of years. He's also been Minister Counsel Deputy Head of Mission at the Embassy of Ukraine in the UK, as well as other roles too. Eduard, welcome to the channel.
Thank you for your invitation. Glad to be here.
Well, we're going to talk about a range of topics, but this is a crucial time. We're in the third year of war, and the UK has, for a considerable part of that, been at the forefront of supplying new capabilities, military capabilities, to help Ukraine defend itself. How important is the embassy within the UK, and how important is the UK as a partner to Ukraine?
Thank you for your question. I don't want to overstate the importance of the embassy, but I would like to believe that we do play an important role in the communications between our government and the UK government. But I'd like to touch upon the one thing that you said, that we are in this crucial stage of the war. I think we should be very careful when talking about such things or labeling them as crucial, because at every stage of the war, it was a crucial period. It was a crucial period in spring 2022. It was a crucial period in the fall of 2022 with the liberation of areas in the east. It was a crucial period over the winter 22-23 when Ukrainian energy infrastructure was being attacked. So the word crucial may imply that after we pass this period, we will be entering a new stage. And I would say that we are still very much in the midst of the war with no clear end in sight, because the Russian Federation is very clear in its public messaging what it wants to achieve in regards to Ukraine. So for us, it's just another period in the war. And because it is turning out into a quite a long conflict, it is absolutely essential that we have such allies as the United Kingdom with us throughout this period, because UK has been with us from the, you can say, from day one till now. It has led on many tracks in the military sphere. It has been playing an important role in accepting Ukrainian citizens who are fleeing the war. It has hosted last year Ukraine Reconstruction Conference, which is on the economic side. So overall, UK is a very important partner of our country in this fight against the Russians, against the Russian aggression. And it continues to be one of the staunchest allies of ours. And we really appreciate it very much. And one of the latest demonstrations of that was the visit earlier this year in January, when the Prime Minister and President signed a security agreement in Kyiv between Ukraine and the United Kingdom.
And as you say, the character of the war has changed from many analysts and politicians believing that Ukraine would not survive more than a few weeks into the war. It seemed that at the start, the provision of munitions was in some ways defensive in character. And of course, that has changed over the period. We still have a lot of air defense systems being provided. But we also see those systems having a dual use, potentially, also having a sort of offensive role. And it's rumored that significant numbers of Russian jet losses are in that sort of dual use. We have seen that kind of shift, haven't we, from purely defensive capabilities to more offensive capabilities, and governments starting to realize that some of Russia's red lines are simply empty threats. But we've also seen the non-supply or slow walking of other capabilities like F-16s and so on. Now, it's a tricky question, isn't it? Because on the one hand, Ukraine needs to show huge gratitude to partners, which is often demanded by partners, I think sometimes a little too much. And on the other hand, you need to balance it with being a little forceful and saying, well, this is what we need, and these are the kind of capabilities we need. How challenging is it from a diplomatic point of view to walk that line between sort of, not causing divisions amongst allies, but making it super clear what support is required?
Well, yeah, you're absolutely right. It is a difficult question and a multifaceted one. First of all, I think from day one, you will recall that Ukraine has put forward a very forceful appeal: close the skies. And at that time, it was looked as something that is probably not going to happen. And then gradually, our allies and partners in the West came to the realization that providing purely defensive weapons or a piecemeal approach, or doing, okay, we will help you with this, but not with this, is not enough. And it is not enough for one simple reason. When there are two sides in the war, and in this regard, Ukraine and Russia, if Ukraine is left without the support on the weaponry side, on the material side, the outcome would be much more, or the disposition of forces would be much more in the favor of the Russian forces. And the end result, you can project, would be numerous Buchas, numerous Izums, because in April we will commemorate this horrible discovery of what has happened in Bucha after the Russians withdrew after the initial assault on Kyiv. So this realization in among our partners, then this piecemeal approach is not working, is not sufficient to make sure that Ukraine will prevail in this war. And then there is another subject that I think this defensive offensive capability, sometimes it's like splitting the hair. And on many levels, many decision makers, politicians, military analysts, they know very well what the end result should be. The end result should be is that Ukraine prevails, that Ukraine defeats the Russian aggression. And to do that, you have to have proper tools. And if you are given just, if you say, a shield you will not be able to push your enemy back. You have to have an offensive capability. And this realization has been, I would say, seeping gradually into the psyche of Western decision making, but it has found its way. We would like to see, of course, the process much faster, but the reality is what it is. But you will also see how resolute and decisive in the actions are our immediate allies, immediate neighbors, you can say, Lithuania, Estonia, Latvia, Poland, because they know what exactly is at stake. They feel it, and they don't want that outcome. That's why they're so much more forceful in their arguments. And when sometimes, as you pointed out, we, Ukraine, may come out as too forceful, too strong with demands, with requests for this or that type of material. I think one aspect to keep in mind that we don't do it just because we want to have the latest or the bestest military hardware so that we can shoot something. No, because it is of a dire need for weapons, because wars are not fought with sticks right now. It's fought with highly sophisticated equipment. And we need that equipment if we are to win in this war. So it's not just some random wish. Okay, I want that. No, it's because we do really need that.
And not because, you know, Ukraine is warlike, which is another one of the labels that occasionally is applied there. One has to say with people who perhaps do not have good intentions towards Ukraine. Another aspect of this, I think, which is sort of interesting, and it's a very slow, unfortunate realization, is our imposition of our standards and our interpretation of the world, our projection of that onto Russia, which may not be appropriate. So, for instance, there has been perhaps a thinking behind Western policymakers that ultimately Russia will behave in an economically and politically rational fashion. Ultimately, after it's got its aggression out of the way, it can be appeased with chunks of territory. That it will come to see that negotiation is a rational decision and outcome. And yet, when we hear many Ukraine analysts, and indeed people from the Baltics, the message is being strong and clear from day one that Putin will not stop until he's stopped, and that his framework of reference, and I wouldn't call it insane because it makes absolute sense from his frame of reference, but it is not economically rational in a Western sense. Is this another challenge that you have to convince people that Putin will not behave in the way we want him to or expect him to, and that our strategy has to adapt accordingly?
I think one of the issues in this oral discussion is, and you touched upon, is the assumption that people in Moscow, the leadership, Putin and his circle, are behaving rationally. But that logic, that rational approach, we frame into our understanding. We try to impose our frames of reference on the thinking of the Russian dictator. And it does not work, because from a rational point of view, it made zero sense to invade Ukraine. And it still makes zero sense to continue this war from our perspective, from this Western rational perspective. But in the terms of reference that Putin is residing, it is the only thing that he sees as a logical outcome of his actions. So I think we should be very careful, and this experience and Western leaders, they have made this choice of hoping that that the Moscow leadership will be rational, but they have displayed that they will not act according to the expectations. They will act according to their own terms of reference. And that caught many people by surprise. They still refuse to believe that you cannot be this irrational. And why not to talk about negotiations, going to the table, sorting out the differences, and so on and so forth. That would be a conversation if we were talking about two sides with two similar points of or frameworks of reference. But in this specific case, in Moscow, you see a completely different set of principles and goals and aims. And the only, it's ideological, first of all, is that Putin does not accept the existence of the Ukrainian nation as such. So once you go into this ideological part, all this logical thinking, reasoning stop working, because it becomes almost, I don't want to use the word religious zeal, but things that are driven by ideology, you cannot reason with them. So, and that's what the Russians are doing. That is why the only way of ending this war is through a military defeat on the battlefield of the Russians.
And for those who also, and again, these are people who do not necessarily support Ukraine, people will say, well, you've got to consider this is, NATO plays a big role in the reasons behind the conflict. Now, I don't buy into that argument at all, but those people who tend to put that argument forward will also try to make the economically rational case that this is just a struggle about resources. There are huge mineral reserves, etc. In eastern Ukraine, you have incredibly fertile land. Russia is just doing something that is economically rational from its point of view. It's a sort of hostile takeover of markets, etc. And so you hear that argument. But the evidence on the ground seems to suggest something else. It seems to suggest that Russia, in the early phases of the long war, dismantled and took apart a lot of the industrial capacity from Donbass and shipped it to Russia. And now we see almost a black earth policy of genocide against the Ukrainian population. Even those who describe themselves as ethnically Russian seem to fall under this, being sent into the meat grinder. And we see the destruction of mines and the polluting of territory. It does not seem that there's any economic rationality there, or that Russia is really thinking too much about utilizing Ukraine as an economic resource. Rather, they want it as a blasted and wasted territory, a kind of empty buffer zone between themselves and the West.
I think there are, again, many aspects to the problem that you have touched upon. First, if we go about NATO, if we are to talk about NATO and they assumed by the Russians interest in having access to Ukraine's resources, fertile land, etc., etc., I think this is the last thing that NATO and NATO member states care and want. It's a counterintuitive argument, but you can see how much problems we have right now on our Western borders with just moving stock across the border because of the proclaimed or assumed issues with Ukrainian grain, as if it is causing huge disruptions in the market, which it does not, but there is a perception of that. So from this perspective, NATO is the last one to be interested in having access to Ukraine's fertile land, so to put out of business French farmers, so to say. That's one thing. Then the other thing is that I'm not a particular fan of the word NATO expansion, because you will recall that new NATO member states, they were the ones pushing very hard, lobbying very hard, banging on all doors to enter NATO. They were not, I would put it this way, welcomed with open hearts from the very beginning. They had to overcome many, many challenges and obstacles to get into NATO. So it was not like a happy-go-merry NATO expansion from Brussels. I think it was the other way around. Countries on the Baltic Sea, Poland, Hungary, Slovak Republic, Czech Republic, and others in the Balkans. I don't want to go into the long list, but they were the ones wanting to join NATO, because it is a defensive alliance. It was an insurance policy for them, because where in Europe you will see NATO acting as an encroachment or going into other countries and doing something. While on the other hand, when you look at Russia's case, you will see the behavior in Moldova, you will see the behavior in Georgia, you will see the behavior in Ukraine. So when Russians were trying to expand militarily the zone of influence, so to say. And again, when we are coming back to the original question about the possible economic rationale, after Russia has stirred up trouble, so to say, in Donbas in 2014, whatever economic enterprises, profitable, big ones, important ones, were there, they have been destroyed, not militarily, but they have been dismantled. Russia is not interested in having a strong economy there. There are no unique resources on Ukraine's territory that Russia does not have on its own. So for them, as you said, Ukraine is an important country in a sense that it helps to expand the area of influence. It provides them with another jumping pot, so to say, for next conquest, because that's what Russia has been doing throughout its history.
Yes, I mean, that's a classic technique of the Muscovite Empire: divide, conquer, expand, salami slicing. Ukraine's path seems to be very different, though. And to pick up your point on NATO, if NATO is this incredible expansionist thing, then surely we would be welcoming Ukraine with open arms. But it seems to be a very slow and very painful process for Ukraine to become integrated with Western institutions such as the EU and NATO. It's not impossible, but it is not an easy or simple process, and it's taking an inordinate amount of time. Also, could you address the idea that actually Ukraine was not generally that keen, looking at polls, on really becoming a part of NATO prior to 2014, and actually the move or the shift in people's minds towards wanting to become a part of these international institutions has grown in response to Russian aggression?
Absolutely. The first part is that we have been working with NATO on the path towards Euro-Atlantic integration, that is becoming a member of NATO, for a long, long, long time. We have had numerous conversations, political consultations at the level of leaders of our aspirations to become part of the alliance. Because from the very beginning, people tasked with the issues of national security, for them it was a clear-cut case that to ensure our national security, to ensure our sovereignty and independence, there is no better way than joining the alliance. That's why the history of our cooperation with the alliance, of our talks, of our aspirations to become an alliance member is a long one. And then we're coming back to the issue that you raised, that before 2014, there was not a huge public support for this dive. And the reason for that, you could trace to the influence of the Russian media. Because despite what Russians are saying about prosecution of the Russian language, about silencing of the Russian media outlets, that's, to put it mildly, is not true, or it's rather a blatant lie. Thus, many people in Ukraine were consumers of this Russian information products, and what they were telling in the Russian information sphere, NATO is bad, Russia is good, Russia is a peaceful country, no threat for us, NATO is an aggressive alliance. And then the reality hit, 2014. People realize that what they have been told were lies. That's why the wider public embraced the idea of NATO membership as something that is important for Ukraine's national interests.
And if we continue on that topic of industry and the destruction of industry, this tying up the sort of lie of discrimination of Russian speakers, etc. In reality, we've seen a huge shift, haven't we, of people fleeing the East, either being able to salvage something of their businesses or create new businesses. But we've seen a tremendous shift from East to West. Whereas Lviv, I remember sort of reading a book about it, just at the end of the Soviet Union, Lviv is fairly, run down economically, not a huge amount going on. Now it seems that Lviv and Kyiv are the economic powerhouses of Ukraine, and Lviv is becoming this incredible kind of cultural and tech hub. Again, is Russian aggression in the East and despoilation of the East really one of the driving factors of the growth of Lviv as a hub of economic development? Is also its proximity to Poland and the EU, that must also play a significant part.
There are several factors I would put here. First of all, is purely an issue of economic development in the modern times, because the importance of legacy heavy industries that were and still are prevalent in the eastern part of Ukraine, I think right now we are moving into a new kind of an economy where much more emphasis will be on added value products, on services, etc., etc. So that's one aspect. And another aspect is that if we had to talk about the current conditions of the wartime, up to 4 million people have been displaced in Ukraine. So it's a huge population shift. And obviously, many of the people who have been displaced from the eastern part, they they were seeking refugee in cities, towns, villages in the western part, where there was a lower risk of being dead, of ending up dead. So there is an influx of people which bring with themselves skills, which bring with themselves ideas, which may be willing to relocate the production facilities of whatever they were manufacturing before in the western part. And that process is similar in different regions, not just in the Lviv region, but in the surrounding areas as well. So there is a shift of that nature. And then there's also another economic pressure. Okay, people are leaving behind their usual lives, their careers, their homes, their jobs. For a while, you can live on your savings, but after a certain amount of time, you have to become active again if you want to preserve the quality of life that you are used to. So people joining the workforce, they're trying to find their place in this new market. So it brings with them some innovation, which is a driving force as well. So there are positive things behind this. There will be also, I don't want to call it a boom, but there will be a higher demand for housing for newcomers all over the place. So that's all the driving factors. But there is another side of this as well. This huge relocation of people, not only inside Ukraine, but also outside Ukraine. And it is estimated that up to 4 million people have left also Ukraine, living beyond its borders. And those people who live in other countries, while they are helping Ukraine in whatever way they can, they send remittances to their family to support them, et cetera, et cetera. But they are not in the active working force in Ukraine. And it's already affecting an overall picture of available and able workforce in Ukraine, which will be and is already is a big negative factor for our economic development. By different estimates, this a loss of people of such magnitude can cost the national GDP between 2 and 7% of GDP, which is quite significant.
Yeah, on top of all the other pressures and issues as well as the as you say, the blockade of land routes in Poland, Hungary and Slovakia, which are extremely challenging. Well, let's turn to this next phase of the war, because as you say, every phase is crucial, but every phase has its own character and its own requirements. And as we have got into more of a attritional phase of more static lines on the ground, we're seeing extraordinary innovation in sea warfare and air warfare as well, where Ukraine seems to be gaining the advantage. That means things like defense manufacturing cooperation are more important now than they were in the sort of survival mode of the first year of the war. Confiscation of Russian assets become even more important because, as you say, there are pressures on the economy and there are need for funds to keep the war going. At this crucial period, we see that President Zelensky has appointed General Valery Zaluzhny to the position of ambassador for Ukraine to the United Kingdom. How important is that appointment at this time, and specifically in the UK, to advance some of the things we've talked about, such as confiscation of Russian assets, defence cooperation, and of course, the crucial supply of munitions, which we know were running short, really, from the end of last year onwards?
Well, first of all, I think it is absolutely important and a very welcome news that there will be a new ambassador coming to London from Ukraine, because this is always a sign of a flourishing relationship between the two countries. And to have Valery Zaluzhny not yet appointed, but nominated, so to say, to fill this post, I think is a hugely symbolic move, because there are not that many people of his caliber. He brings with himself incomparable, I would say, experience of fighting proverbial the second biggest army in the world. So he brings with himself this experience. He brings with himself huge name recognition. And that will be absolutely valuable assets in further developing of our relations with the UK. And when we talk about joint military production, the pure economic logic also dictates that it's much cheaper, it's much better to have equipment manufactured, repaired, maintained close to where it is needed, instead of having to rely on long logistic chains through several borders, losing time, losing money. That's why it is it's one of the priorities for our government right now to have a robust military cooperation with our allies, and to have as much as possible repair maintenance facility inside Ukraine. And in this regard, we already have some progress with UK and other countries as well. Is there anything that I missed in your question?
No, I think. Well, there's the other one is the confiscation of Russian assets. I mean, this is a crucial step. We're talking about $300 billion here. It is enough certainly to get Ukraine through the next 2 years, and there are estimates that shows that the Russian economy could potentially sustain war and sustain a limited mobilization for the next 2 years. So it would seem these funds are critical at this point and over the next coming sort of months and years.
Yeah, I knew I missed some things. Russian assets, there are several issues to unpack here. First of all, the cost of the war itself. It is very expensive to fight wars. And most of the support that we were getting from our Western allies were in the form of materiel, not cash. And then those procurement that was done by our side, it was done from the Ukrainian budget, from the Ukrainian taxpayers' money. And then, because of this ongoing war, our economy has shrunk considerably, and we have to cover quite a bit of our state budget. And that's where this microfinancing from outside comes into place. And when we talk about the amounts, by the latest estimates of the World Bank, Ukraine will need up to $480 billion of financing to finance the recovery effort. That's one point. Then there is the issue of the seized, frozen Russian assets in the east, in the Western countries. The question becomes, okay, where do we want that amount of money to come from? From the pocket of Western taxpayers? Or there is this amount of the Russian money that is there, which would be only fair and just to use to finance, to compensate, so to say, for all that damage that the Russians have done already. So from our perspective, these frozen Russian assets should become the main source of financing for Ukraine's recovery. There are different views, different or competing arguments on how to do it, but there are ways of doing it. Now is just important for all allies to come to an understanding what is the best way that will suit everyone, that will be acceptable for everyone. So to continue on this path of ensuring not only that Western money is saved, but also to ensure that justice is served and that Ukraine is properly financed. Because counting on Russia voluntarily paying for its crimes, I think it's a little bit, it's a stretch too far.
Yes, and even a future so-called liberal regime in Russia may have issues electorally selling that to its people, the idea to fully compensate Ukraine. Well, it can never fully compensate for the crimes being committed, but the material position in any case. Just two areas I wanted to explore before we finish. One, of course, is that we have a very active election season coming up. And, of course, there is the crucial US election, which at the moment seems very much in the balance. Without getting too political, these elections do represent a risk, don't they? A risk to relations between Ukraine and its allies, and a risk potentially to the further supply of essential munitions from some key partners. So what is Ukraine able to do during this period to try and, you know, keep those relations going, even if difficult transitions may come up as a result of those election outcomes?
Yeah, I think it's not very often in history that so many elections are held in the same year throughout the world and against such a volatile international background. But overall, elections are good because it's democracy in action. The outcome of the elections are what they are. It's what people choose, what they vote for. So our approach is that whatever the outcome is, we are working with the elected officials, with representatives of those governments, of those countries. And of course, there may be a change, and probably there will be transitions in other parts of the world with the new leaders coming to the offices. But it's not for us to decide who will be sitting in that or the other chair, but we will continue our dialogue, our work with the elected officials. And while, since you mentioned the US, and it's hard for me to comment on the US election processes because I am based in London, in the UK, on the Ukrainian file, so to say, there is a consensus or a mutual understanding of many things by both the Labour Party, by the Conservative Party, by the Scottish Nationalist Party, by the Liberal Democratic Party. So there is an overarching joint understanding of how important that issue is. So if there is a change in the government, the general approach will be the same. And that is something that we really cherish, because for diplomats, it's hugely important to nurture the relationship with the country, not with a specific individual. The kind of relationship that we have right now with the UK gives us hope that it will grow and grow and grow. And with the US elections, they will be what they are. Our president has invited Donald Trump to visit Ukraine. So we are open for dialogue, we have worked, Ukraine has worked with his administration before. So that's, yeah, maybe there are issues for concern for on some aspects, but let's not forget that it's an electoral season, and the administration will be there in any case, whoever is the head of that administration. So we will be working with the power, with people who are elected.
And the last question comes back to the initial idea we were talking about, and this is that Putin won't stop until he's stopped. We've just seen him potentially murdering his main political rival. We see him doubling down on autocracy. The election, which is widely believed to be not just partially falsified this time, as previous elections have been, but fully manufactured in terms of its result. We see almost a return to 1930s style repression, not at that scale yet, but it's heading in that direction. As part of that, it's highly conceivable that there will be a new round of either explicit or implied mobilization across Russia, which of course is a threat. We also know that Ukraine as a democracy needs to mobilize, and this was a big theme of General Zaluzhny, but as a democracy, it needs to be very sensitive to rule of law, to rights of individuals, and to reflect what people in the country believe and want to see happening. Is this one of the reasons why it's been particularly complex to get mobilization-related law through the parliament? I believe the latest round of negotiations in the Rada was happening just this week. But will Ukraine have to, in some ways, meet the challenge from a potential Russian mobilization coming prior to the summer?
Oh, there are some issues that are easier to discuss for a diplomat, like bilateral relations. And what you have raised is more of an internal political issue. And that, of course, are better answered by people's deputies, by our parliamentarians in the Verkhovna Rada, how and what they are doing to introduce amendment into the existing legislation. One of the reasons for doing it is that the previous legislation was framed for the peacetime. And now the pressures of the of being in the war have highlighted that certain aspects of the overall approach by the state to the mobilization issue as such have to be amended. That's one of the things. So mobilization as such has not stopped. It has been ongoing. Now there is a need to introduce some modification in that process. And whatever modifications will end up in the law, of course, will be up to the parliament. And they're working on that, and there are very lively debates on different aspects. But
doesn't that show that Ukraine has
they
a
will
robust
be coming
democracy?
To some understanding. Yes.
Doesn't that, yeah, that it's a democratic process, it's not a dictatorial process, which is important.
Oh, something that you will find a constant sign in Ukraine is that there is nothing constant in Ukraine's political life. We had constant changes in presidents. The composition of our parliament is also quite fluid one. So new people come, other people leave. So there is a vibrant political life. Yes, you can say that. And on this regard, of course, there is the aspect of the overall war effort, which adds another, I don't want to say complication, but it puts a different level of pressure on the politicians, of people who are holding the public office, because it's up to them how to run the country in the wartime.
Well, Edward, thank you so much for speaking to us. I think it's especially important that people in the UK, both the electorate and, as you say, the parties, there's a degree of unanimity about the justness of Ukraine's cause. And I'm pleased that we are fully behind Ukraine with very, very few dissenters in that view. And I wish you luck in your mission. And I hope that mission continues and grows in strength as General Zaluzhny hopefully takes his office as is intended. But thank you so much for the work of you and your colleagues. Yeah, I wish you the energy you need to continue this resilience into the third year of war.
Thank you very much for this conversation. I hope I was able to answer some of the questions to my modest abilities. And I also want to thank you, the UK public, for all that support that they have shown throughout these more than 2 years already, and it's hugely appreciated. Thank you very much.